French cow is le mou. The British cow goes mou. I say mou. The Italian cow goes mwah, mwah. Man, I hate it when they do that. As many of you know, we are actually videotaping the opening segment here on Stand to Reason. By the way, Greg Kokel here. So I got to be careful what I say off the air, because that videotape may be going on, and you never know when it's going to come back, and you like that last little clip. The show is Stand to Reason, and odd name for a show given that opening, but what we do is carefully think about the critical issues of life, ethics, values, and religion. My number, 1-800-227-5278. In the 714 area code, you can dial direct at 754-4150. And in hour number two, we're going to take your calls hour number one, so you are welcome to get in the queue and get ready to chat with me after I have some opening comments. But the second hour, we'll be interviewing a conversation with Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck, who have written a book, Why We're Not Emergent, by two guys who should be. And we have been given, pardon me, we have been given three copies of their book to distribute. And since I don't usually take calls during the interview, because I want to talk to these guys and I got a lot of questions and that's just my style. So it isn't like you can call during the interview and then get the book. We're going to be giving the book to the first three callers who want it, if you're interested in the issue. And this is actually very nicely written, and I think a very even-handed kind of critique of some of the concerns in the broader emerging church movement. We will, if you call and are among the first three callers for this first hour, we'll arrange to have that sent to you. You can talk to the enforcer and tell her, yeah, I want Why We're Not Emergent by two guys who should be. That would be Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck. I have been reading, I just got back from Colorado yesterday, and was reading on the plane the new book by Alistair McGrath called The Dawkins Delusion, in response to Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. And by the way, you know, there are three responses to that book that have the word delusion in it. This one, Dawkins Delusion, Dawkins Dangerous Delusion, and I don't know, The Deluded Delusion or something like that. There are just all these delusion books coming out in response to Dawkins' book. And I noticed on one of the pages here, halfway through the book, McGrath cites Dawkins' objection about taking the Bible literally. So a big part of what Dawkins' attack on religion entails not only the promotion of science as kind of ending the discussion about religion and the existence of God, but also then focusing in on religion and seeing how bad it is. And he notes here, McGrath does, that Dawkins insists that to take the Bible seriously is to, and here now he's quoting Dawkins, strictly observe the Sabbath and think it is just and proper to execute anyone who chose not to, and also to execute disobedient children, close quote. Now, of course, these are things part of the Old Testament law, and if you take the Bible literally, then that means you must apply all aspects of the Old Testament law. And if you're not applying it now, then obviously you don't take it literally. Now, you don't apply this now, therefore you don't take it literally, therefore you don't really take it seriously, and it's just a bunch of nonsense like Dawkins says it is. And this is actually similar to what we talked about last week when my niece Kirsten had sent a question, hey, Uncle Greg, regarding her friend who is challenging her about taking the Bible literally. And I actually gave you only half of that interchange, mine with her, in response to Pete's challenge and question. And I thought, well, in light of this piece that I just read in McGrath's book on Dawkins and Dawkins' own kind of challenge here, since this really amounted to the second half of my discussion with Kirsten, I thought I'd just kind of bring you up to date and add this second half of that discussion. If you recall, the first part of the discussion from last week was, what was Jesus' take on homosexuality? Did he say anything about it? And I gave an answer to that. And you can refer back to last week's podcast or to the YouTube, the visual, the tape that we did of that to get my answer to that. And I also, if you recall, I had a couple of other questions for Pete before I even got into my response. One of them was, well, what if Jesus weighed in against homosexuality? Would that change your view? And there were some others as well. And again, like I said, you can refer back to that week if you want. But here is what, after sending the response that I shared with you last week, Kirsten received this response back from Pete. And now I'm quoting from the email. The Old Testament is part of the Bible. You've said that the Bible is God's word, that we should take it literally. Now, this is what she said to him. And if you recall from last week, I warned you against saying that, because the statement, we take the Bible literally, is wildly ambiguous, too easy to be misunderstood. And I suggested rather that you say, we take the Bible at face value. In other words, you read metaphors as metaphors, other figures of speech as figures of speech, and those things which we seem to be factual statements about reality as factual statements about reality if we have no good reason, given the context, to take it differently. This is the way you read anything in literature. It's the way you read the sports page. And so a counter question might be, do you take the sports page literally? And the response, of course, is, well, that depends. If you're reading scores, factual information, yes. If it says, you know, one team devoured another, you realize that cannibalism's not going on there. So you realize it's a figure of speech that is meant to communicate a literal idea, which you distill from the figures of speech quite easily. And you read the Bible just like you read anything else for the most part. There's some exceptions with apocalyptic literature in the book of Revelation and that kind of thing. But generally speaking, I think that's the response that it should be. And anyway, she said, I take the Bible literally, so he picks up on this. And he offers the response, a rejoinder, to my first answer of his question that I offered last week. He says, you said we should take the Bible literally, and if the Bible is God's true and infallible word, as she claims, should we follow it strictly and literally? And if you exempt the Old Testament from being God's word, thus it would then be infallible. I think what he means there, if you exempt it from being God's word, and therefore you're saying that it's fallible, that is what he says. Then you're admitting that the Bible is in fact fallible and subject to interpretation. By the way, just make a note here that he is equating fallibility with being subject to interpretation. He continues, putting homosexuals to death as mandated in the Old Testament doesn't mean we shouldn't take the Bible literally, but it does mean that if you do take the Bible literally, then morally you should advocate in favor of the death penalty for homosexuals. And if someone's unwilling to do that, then they are either hypocritical or they're opening the Bible up for interpretation. Now, none of us really take the Bible to be completely literal. And so now he's saying, obviously, he's right on this. That's a problem. So it just points out that nobody really takes the Bible literally. There are just varying degrees of interpretation, because Jesus said he was a shepherd. He was not. And we are his sheep. I, for one, am not a sheep. Also, if we are to take everything completely literally, why did Jesus talk so much about mustard seeds and women at wells and things like that? Well, he actually talked about the woman at the well because there was a woman at the well that he was talking with, but he's confused there. In any event, he says, I have personally no use for advice on mustard seeds. And then he extends his question again. Have you found anything Jesus said about homosexuality? Now, this is the response that he gave to the comments that I offered last week. And Kirsten simply advances them to me and then says, help. How do you respond? And I told her that my point in my last email was that Jesus supported the whole law for the circumstances it was meant to cover. That is, the Jews under the theocracy. But then I went on to respond more precisely to Pete's challenge. And what I needed to do, since all of this was about, taking the Bible literally, and it was the same objection that Richard Dawkins raises when he says, if you take it literally, then you have to execute people that don't keep the Sabbath, and you've got to execute disobedient children. So I thought, well, let's figure out what literally means. And I know what it means, but since there was confusion on this, apparently, I went back to the dictionary. What is the New Oxford American Dictionary defined literal as? Taking words in their usual and most basic sense without metaphor or allegory, free from exaggeration or distortion. Okay. In other words, you don't take metaphors literally. because they're figure of speech. Same thing of allegory. You don't exaggerate or distort. If you're taking it literally, you take it in its most basic, straightforward sense. Kind of like what I said a few moments ago when I said the way to read the Bible is to take it at face value. And so this is the sense of literal that I think is the operative sense that ought to be employed in these kinds of discussions. Now, to take the Levitical law literally means that the words of the Mosaic law are to be understood in their ordinary sense. There's no metaphors, no allegory. And this is the case, by the way, that the way that we read any legal code. We understand it literally. However, we only apply that legal code to those under the jurisdiction of that legal code. And this is the blunder, I think, that both Pete and Richard Dawkins are making when they're talking about the idea of taking the Bible literally. Yes, there was a legal code for the Jews, and the Jews took it literally at face value because laws are written that way. But that doesn't mean that it applies the same way to us as Christians, even though we understand those laws under that set of circumstances to be understood in a literal sense. So the question we face as Christians is not whether or not those directions are to be taken literally, and clearly they were taken that way by the Jews under the law, but rather whether we are now under that same legal code. I mean, look at I live in California. I am under the California legal codes. I'm supposed to understand those codes literally. Now, if you're in Vermont and you're reading the California legal codes to understand what the California legal codes mean, you still are obliged, it seems to me, to understand those literally. Being in a different state doesn't mean you read them in a different way. It simply means that those laws that you understand literally do not apply to you because you are not the people who fall under the jurisdiction of that law. I mean, that's pretty straightforward, right? Now, Peter, who Kirsten was interacting with here, seems to think that if a biblical command is to be taken literally, then it is to be applied universally. The same mistake that Dawkins makes in his book, The God Delusion. Now, think of this. Jesus told Peter to cast his net into deep water. Now, was Peter to understand Jesus' words literally or figuratively? Well, I suspect literally because of what Peter did. What did he do? He cast his net into deep water, and he caught a lot of fish. Now, just because we understand Jesus' command to Peter to be literal, it does not mean that you and I are obliged to cast our nets into deep water. This was a directive to Peter, not to us. It only applied to him. And in the same way, the words of the Mosaic law, like all laws, are to be understood in their usual and most basic sense without metaphor or allegory, free from exaggeration or distortion. That's our definition of literal. The Jews and the theocracy, then, they have an obligation to obey this law in that way because that's the legal code that God gave to them. But it's not the legal code that God gave to Gentiles. Therefore, even if the words are to be taken literally, it does not mean that there is universal application of those words to us now. Both Pete and Dawkins are mistaken on this point. And by the way, if anybody thinks otherwise, like Pete, then he is obliged to buy a net and throw it in deep water because Jesus said so. By the way, I was a little bit bothered by the challenge of hypocritical for those people who don't take the Bible literally in the way that Pete suggested. Because a hypocrite, and mark this, by the way, so that you don't get hit by this sucker punch. A hypocrite is a faker. He isn't simply somebody who doesn't do what he thinks is right. Some people are inconsistent in their behavior. Some people are morally weak. They affirm one set of moral rules, but they don't keep them. They do something else. By the way, that's pretty much everybody. Nobody, no matter what side of the aisle you're on in this discussion, Christian or non-Christian, moralist or relativist, nobody does everything they think that they should be doing. That doesn't make everybody a hypocrite. The word hypocrite comes from the words that describe an actor, somebody who puts a mask on. A hypocrite, then, is a faker, somebody who pretends to be one thing and turns out to be something completely different. He's a pretender. He is somebody who is insincere. So it's not hypocritical when one makes a good faith attempt at making proper distinctions about the application of verses. The hypocrisy challenge, I think, is not a substantive response. It's just another example of name calling. I think this, in this case, it's a weak attempt at that. Poisoning the well. Ooh, if you don't see it my way, you're a hypocrite. Nonsense. And as for making the Bible subject to interpretation, I hope you realize that all language is subject to interpretation. This cannot be avoided. Everything needs to be interpreted. You are interpreting my words right now as you listen. You can't do otherwise. You are listening to the words that I speak. You are being aware, somewhat subconsciously, I guess, of the context in which I speak and to what I'm speaking. And you are drawing conclusions about my meaning from all of those things. And it may be that you misunderstand my meaning. And if some of you have a discussion afterwards about what Kokel really had in mind when he gave his opening commentary on the show on Sunday, you probably will adjudicate the differences by trying to go back to the words and to figure out what exactly was an accurate take given those circumstances and those words. I mean, you can't avoid this. Sometimes people's statements are largely univocal. In other words, it's hard to imagine how they can mean something else. But a lot of times they're equivocal. They could mean different things, and you have no choice but try to interpret and figure out what's going on. There's nothing dishonest or disingenuous or untoward about this process. It's the nature of communication. And so to say that the Bible is subject to interpretation is only to say that the Bible is written in words. It's an attempt of communication by one person to another through the medium of language, and we have to try to figure out what this author intended to mean by the words he used. That's it. Can't avoid that. It does not at all mean that the Bible itself is not authoritative or inspired. If God were to speak from the clouds right now, and we're going to say stipulate it is in fact God speaking, so by definition these are the infallible, inspired, inerrant words of God, we would still have to what? Interpret them. We'd have to figure out what they meant. But that doesn't mean they are any less from God as a result. By the way, and just closing in this, I agree with Peter that metaphors like sheep and analogies like the mustard seed are to be understood in their normal sense as figures of speech. But this does not mean that the task of interpretation is completely open-ended. Like any interpretation is just as good as any other interpretation. So strictly speaking, there are not varying degrees of interpretation, but rather different kinds of language or literature that need to be interpreted. So we could have factual stuff, straightforward factual stuff. We could have poetry. We could have history. We could have, you know, music, songs. All of these are to be understood in light of their genre. But it isn't like varying degrees of interpretation that in some sense cast doubt on the authority of those things that have been spoken. And by the way, and I closed to my niece Kirsten on this note, what did Peter say about the other questions I asked? And if you recall from last week, there were about six or seven of them that were things that he had to address in virtue of his own position and his own challenge. Like if he doesn't take this literally, you know, about homosexuals in the Old Testament, what about Jesus' command to love your enemies? Gee, why would you take that literally? Now that is a silly-sounding issue. Who would ever say you must love your enemies? Now, of course, we know Jesus said that a long time ago. We're used to it, and so it kind of is familiar to our ears. But set yourself outside of that for a moment and take that statement Wouldn't it sound so bizarre that you'd be inclined not to take it literally the first time you heard it? But they seem to take this literally and at face value. So those are some of the questions I asked, which did not get an answer. By the way, even if I am a hypocrite for not promoting the execution of homosexuals, Jesus as God was responsible for that part of the Bible. I didn't make that up. All right? Jesus did not promote homosexuality. Instead, he identified God's ordained order of one man, one woman, and monogamous marriage, and that's another thing you can't get away from, no matter how you resolve this other issue. Okay, there you go. Coming up next, your calls, comments, questions here on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Tired of defending your faith with, "The Bible says so," "does too," or "I think it does"? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Come and listen in to a radio station where the mighty host of heaven sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on. All right, Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday from 3 to 5. 1-800-227-5278, the number in the 714 area, code 754-4150. Let's go to Wichita Falls. That looks like Texas. I thought that was in Kansas. Daniel.
Yes, sir. How are you doing today?
Fine. What state are you in?
I'm in Texas, actually.
I thought Wichita Falls was in Kansas for some reason.
Yeah, normally most people would think that, but actually it's on the northern border right by Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Well, glad you called. What's on your mind today?
Well, thanks for taking my call. Actually,
sure.
The question I have today, the relevance of apologetics in our time, I guess, given the increasingly postmodern climate, it seems.
Uh-huh.
The question I have basically is, it seems to assume today that people seem to be still persuaded by the strength of your reasoning or the substance of one's logic, when it seems like increasingly, when you get into these debates today, you kind of wonder, I get to the point where I wonder, when someone, say, for instance, calls my view irrational, are they really saying something about the logic that makes up my view, or is that just a tactic that tries to rely to manipulate the sense impressions of the listeners to kind of associate this view with irrationality?
Is that what they tell you? When you're giving them an argument, is that what they tell you?
Well, say, here's an example, just to kind of clear. Like, for instance, you can see, you might have heard about the Guillermo Gonzalez situation, and unfortunately he was a
Right, from Iowa State, I think, or University.
Exactly. Yeah, so Iowa State University mm-hmm. published the book Privilege Planet.
Right.
And by all reasonable accounts, you can pretty much see how just his position on this particular issue seemed to just torpedo his career from being denied tenure.
Right. This is a perfect example of what this new movie just out called Expelled is all about.
Yeah, exactly. And it's about time that people began to see the tactics of the massive
right.
PR campaigns that have been launched, as opposed to just actually grappling with the reasoning of one's.
Sure, but
there.
Just as a point here, Daniel, that's really a modernist project that's going after people like Guillermo Gonzalez. Those aren't the postmoderns that are saying that. So how does that relate to the postmodern concern of apologetics?
Well, in particular, I guess here I am as an undergraduate of the university, right?
Okay.
And I'm at a crossroads of deciding two career choices. One, I'd love to go and pursue philosophy just because it gives you that clarity of reasoning.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
On the other hand, and then there's the political science aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And the two cultures seem to be different and distinct in this one respect.
Mm-hmm.
That in one aspect, if you go to the political science route, it seems like, as long as you get to your favorable outcome, whether mm-hmm. it be an election or a PR campaign, the strength of your reasoning is secondary, it seems
mm-hmm.
to be.
Okay,
so,
right. Let me try to respond to that. I think I know where you're going here. And I think that even in a postmodern culture, people are influenced by good arguments just as much as they were in the modernist culture. Even though people in a postmodern culture tend to be more suspicious of reason and rationality in their dialogues about these things, they are still deeply committed to those notions because they turn out to be human beings that are made in the image of God, and they have to live in a world in which reason and rationality are part of the structure of reality. They can't get away from those things. And if you listen to their conversation, you will hear them employing a lot of the same kinds of rational elements or concerns that you associate maybe with modernist thinking. For example, postmoderns can still object to the existence of God based on the presence of evil in the world.
Right, exactly.
That's trades on the law of non-contradiction. They might say, well, Christianity must be false because so many Christians are hypocrites. Now, there's a logical fallacy involved there, but notice how they are trying to think logically. They are offering evidence that brings them what they think to a legitimate conclusion. So notice how even postmoderns are reasoning. Now,
right.
I need to make a distinction here, and I'll let you jump in because you're thinking, wait a minute, how does this – this sounds a little suspicious because I know postmoderns like issue, at least verbally, the idea of rationality. And it turns out that a lot of people are swayed in a sense by the political considerations or the rhetoric, and they aren't always swayed by the argument. The problem here, Daniel, that's true. But it is equally true – that is equally true for moderns as well as postmoderns. This simply makes the point that people of any kind of philosophical persuasion can still be influenced by style and not substance. The rhetoric, especially people who are not carefully schooled in how to think critically, the rhetoric can still overcome good thinking. So people under political suasion end up drawing the wrong conclusions. Certainly, they may not be rational, but the problem here isn't that they're really deep down they are distrustful of rationality. It's rather that they aren't really well schooled in how rationality works, and therefore the postmoderns are just as susceptible to being taken in by rhetoric and informal fallacies as the moderns are. I think that the problem here that you're identifying is not really a modernist postmodern kind of issue, but rather an issue of either those on either side of the aisle that just don't know how to think carefully and therefore can be easily persuaded by fallacious rhetorical appeals. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that makes sense. It's probably just finding a better word to describe, I guess, what I'm looking at. A good example, probably, I think you've mentioned this before, how Christopher Hitchens, in fact, I think he debated Jay Richards recently.
Yes, he did.
Right, and it was noted how essentially Hitchens seems to have that particular gift of being able to use rhetoric and
right.
so forth. And so you kind of look at this and you think, sometimes I've come to to my viewpoints using the reasoned substantive logic of, you know, coming to my conclusions here. But once I get there, and I'm thinking, what is more effective at this point? If I really want to reach as many people as possible, at some point it's like, do I have to make a pragmatic choice now? Is this the kind of time we're living in? And that's a very disturbing question to ask.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's an either-or like that. Here's the way I put it in the past, Daniel, because I've got to answer that question for myself. And the way I put it in the past is, our obligation is to present the truth as clearly and as persuasively as possible. Now, when we present the truth clearly, then I think it becomes persuasive in itself, but we can also add persuasive elements to it in our stylistic elements. What we never want to do, and you can find this point being made as one of the items of the 10 virtues of an ambassador. So if you go to the Ambassador's Creed at str.org, you're going to see, I can't remember exactly what the virtue is here, but the description of it is that we don't use rhetoric or empty rhetoric as persuasive tools, but rather it's empty rhetoric as persuasive tools. But rather we are trying to use language properly to be persuasive of the truth, not to distort the issues. Now, this is a skill, of course, that we develop over time, but this is a goal that a good ambassador wants to have. So I think we can do that. Daniel, I think we can use persuasive language, but in a way to illuminate the truth, not to distort it. And I think people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, especially, use their significant persuasive capabilities to mask what, for I think careful critical thinkers, are obvious logical fallacies that come up. So I don't think we have to go that way, and I think we can still be persuasive and still be focusing in on the truth.
Right. We nonetheless have a duty, I suppose. And so, well, thank you very much for answering the question. I think it helps clear up a lot of things. I'd still at this point to have to decide which career path to follow.
Yeah, sure.
The realities. And so,
well, I would like to think that if you're going to be a politician, you go into political science, whatever, that you still want to draw from the critical thinking skills of philosophy. And here I'm thinking about, you know, there's a lot to philosophy. You know, it is the deep thought about those foundational issues like ethics and metaphysics and, you know, and existence and all of that. But knowledge, epistemology. But I think you can get some critical thinking skills. You can see how arguments work and to see whether someone's argument that whether it's sound or valid, whether it works, whether the evidence for a point of view actually does support it, or whether they're using kind of these informal fallacies like name calling or circular reasoning or genetic fallacy to kind of distract from the core. I've been giving this talk on the New Atheists, and one of element of it is to show, I have a very short and quick section to show how reason works and how you try to take an argument and isolate it and then eliminate the stuff that doesn't really belong. And I do that with Richard Dawkins's core argument of his book, which he outlines for us. And you see, after you kind of you weed some of that stuff out, that there's the irrelevant stuff, there's almost nothing left of his argument. So if you're able to get a hold of that Master Series talk, I think you can see how I do a little bit of that, and I give you a short course in critical thinking there.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it.
You're welcome, Daniel. I appreciate the call. And by the way, you know, I've written a piece that when you sign up for Stand to Reason, if you go to str.org and you sign up to receive our Solid Ground, which is our bi-monthly newsletter, we will send you a welcome packet, say, you know, welcome to the team kind of thing. But in that packet is a little booklet, and it's entitled The Most Important Thing I Could Ever Teach You. And the subtitle is, and here it's kind of reversed because the subtitle is really the title, and the subtitle is Never Read a Bible Verse. Now, some of you know this concept. I've talked about it on the air. I've taught about it quite a bit. But the most important thing that I could ever teach you is to how to read your Bible accurately so you get the knowledge that God wants you to get from it. Now, I am actually thinking about writing, I was talking to the Enforcer today, writing another booklet that would be kind of the advanced step for a course that Stand to Reason would do. And this is going to be the second most important thing I could ever teach you. And that is basic training for your mind, which is an expansion of what I've done in my first article dealing with the new atheists, which will be coming out in May in Solid Ground, an expansion of that of how to assess an argument. What are critical thinking skills? And I offer four different steps there. First, you ask, what is the point? What is the conclusion? What are they trying to prove? What's the big idea? What do you mean by that? If you're from the Columbo perspective, the second step is, how did you come to that conclusion? That is, what are the reasons that are being advanced to convince you that this conclusion, this opinion, is a true one? Third, going through and weeding out those appeals that turn out to be irrelevant to the argument itself. So all of the red herrings and rabbit trails and informal fallacies and nonsense, you get rid of that stuff until you're down to the basic evidence that is meant to support the basic conclusion. And then your final step is easy. You look at it and ask whether it does the job. So this is actually coming out, a very, very modest form of that, in the next Solid Ground, shipping out in a couple weeks, I guess, May 1st. When is that? Week and a half. And you'll get a feel for that. But I want to expand that just a bit in a booklet and eventually expand it in a Stand to Reason interactive course of some sort so you can use this with homeschoolers and everything else. But I this is such an important skill, this ability to be able to listen to somebody offer a persuasive case or what they want to be a persuasive case. Christopher Hitchens, for example, Richard Dawkins, or me, anyone. And to be able to go through it then and say, okay, let's slow down and let's see what you got. What is it you're trying to persuade me to believe? Write it out, that specific thing. Now, sometimes in a challenge or a statement, there are two or three opinions that are being advanced, and you have to isolate them one from the other. And then you ask, gee, what is the individual evidence that you just gave for each of these individual things? Now, if you gave no evidence, then there's no argument. It's just an opinion. And it seems to me anybody who advances the opinion or makes the claim has the obligation to support the opinion or claim with evidence. So the burden isn't on me to disprove somebody's wild fantasy. The burden is upon them to give reasons why I should take it seriously. As I say in the tactics material, they got a lot of splaining to do themselves, and they got to come up with the explanation, and that's their job and it's not mine. And once you can get those things isolated and listed, it allows you then to kind of work through the rhetoric or see past the rhetoric or weed the rhetoric out and see if there's a con job going on. And I will tell you, most of the time, especially in politics, it's a con job. And a lot of religious stuff is a con job, both sides of the aisle. In other words, you can be fed a con job even when the point of view being advanced is actually true. Christians often have the right answer for the wrong reasons. When you have the right answer for the wrong reasons, it's still a con job, in my view, because the solution or the conclusion or the opinion or the point of view does not follow from the reasons that you've offered. Now, people who get the right conclusion for the wrong reasons, in my view, get lucky. But it'd be better for you to get the right answer on purpose rather than by accident. And that's where, you know, a booklet like I've just described will help, or a course that we could provide. So, you know, hopefully in the next sometime in the future, we'll provide something like that for you, for training for yourself, for your church, for your homeschool kids, whatever. But if you get this month's May 1st, issue of Solid Ground, you'll see an example of that in play and how I use that method then to dismember Richard Dawkins' argument against God. And I'm not patting myself on the back here, because it doesn't take any skill to dismember this argument. If you follow the steps, the argument falls apart all on its own because there's virtually nothing there. So be sure that you get this month's May's Solid Ground. Just call 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason. You can sign up that way. You can go to our website and sign up for Solid Ground that way. There's lots of different ways you can get it, but be sure to get it. And this will be the first of at least 3 issues dealing with the new atheist. Okay, more calls coming up in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These 2 new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. The show is Stand to Reason. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Greg Kokel, one of the good guys here, equipping you to think every weekend, 3 to 5 Sundays. That would be Los Angeles time if you're a podcast listener and you want to call in and chat. Let's jump back to the phones. And in Los Angeles, Adam, this is a rare call from Los Angeles, Adam. It seems like we get most of our calls outside of our broadcast footprint now, but I'm glad to talk to you.
Yeah, I actually live in Los Angeles, and this is the first time I've even listened live. I usually listen on the podcast.
Oh, right. Well, the podcasts aren't scratchy, are they? You know, sometimes you listen on the radio, and you might get interference.
Yeah, I take the bus to and from school, so it's a nice time to be able to listen in, too. So.
Perfect, perfect. What's on your mind today, Adam?
Well, I'm writing a paper on whether it's ethical for physicians to offer screening for Down syndrome to pregnant women.
Like an amniocentesis or something like that, right?
Well, there's that, and
there are other methods, I guess.
Yeah, there's an earlier screening that can give the probability of whether
right.
the baby has Downs, whereas the amnio gives a conclusive yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of dealing with both of those, but focusing more on the screening. A while back, I heard on one of your podcasts, so I don't know how long ago it was, I'm pretty sure you either implied or stated outright that you thought physicians giving an amniocentesis weren't acting properly.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the high likelihood that a positive result would lead to an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, well, if that's in fact what you said, and the reason for that, why you think it'd be unethical for a physician to do the test knowing that some of the patients might use it, might end up having an abortion based on the results. And also, if it would help at all if a physician were to upfront offer a screening or a test and say, I'm offering it to you, but I think it's unethical to do it if you know you're going to abort.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do know that, you should see another physician or something like that.
Right. Okay, let me try to clarify or maybe nuance my earlier comments. I do not believe that amniocentesis or these other kinds of screenings are themselves immoral. even for the purpose that we've described, and that purpose being to find out whether or not the child has a congenital defect, and this usually these are for Down syndrome because they're genetic right. assessments. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Now, my understanding is that there may be some risk or small risk to the unborn child as a result of at least the amnio, because you have to pierce the chorion or whatever, and you get in there and take some of the amniotic fluid, and I guess sometimes that can go south. But I think that's true of any kind of procedure that you might do, and you always have to weigh the benefits to the liabilities. If there is some benefit that you perceive in doing this, and the liability is very, very modest, then I don't see any reason why you can't go forward with it. So I would say that the act itself is not immoral.
Right.
But there is a thing that's called a slippery slope. And I think people commonly misunderstand slippery slopes in a very, very general sense, like, well, one thing leads to the next. Well, in a sense, that's true. But when you think ethically, slippery slopes ought to be more precisely defined. And so there is what's called a logical slippery slope and a causal slippery slope. In the case of a logical slippery slope, I'm sorry, causal, because I think that's the only one that would apply here, sometimes one act itself may not be wrong when done in isolation, but it leads to or causes some other act that is itself immoral. For example, is it wrong to – and actually this would be an appropriate metaphor, I think, or parallel analogy. Is it wrong to sell a handgun to someone else?
No.
No, I don't think so. But if that other person said, I want to buy a handgun, and the reason I want to buy a handgun is to shoot my brother-in-law or something, or the guy down the street. Now, do you think that the moral obligation for the person selling the handgun changes in virtue of this new information?
Yeah, I think so. And
given that the selling is directly – you're enabling somebody to do something that is egregiously immoral. Go ahead.
Right. Well, I'm wondering – I think that case is perfectly clear. I'm wondering if it matters if the physician doesn't know. Say he or she chooses not to even ask the patient why – like whether they would abort.
Right. Okay. Well, no. Okay. What I was trying to, in the first comments, to lay out a conceptual framework. So we now kind of know what we're working with, and now we've got that. So now we've got the guy who sells guns, and all kinds of people come in, and he says, "You know what? I'm not going to ask you what you want the gun for. Gangbanger, mob guy, whatever, you know. I'm just going to play ignorant." Okay, do you think that, especially if the circumstances themselves suggest something untoward, do you think he's saved from his moral responsibility by saying, I'm just not going to ask? I mean, if a guy comes in and asks for a, you know, 30-06, and he's got a, you know, he's got a deer hunting cap on, and he's a member of the NRA, and, you know, deer season starts out 2 weeks or something like that, you know, then you think, well, he's probably going to go deer hunting with it. He's not going to be, you know, plinking at college students. So, I think those kinds of considerations enter in here. So let's just get to your specific question. If I were a doctor, I would not be concerned about giving an amniocentesis in itself. But I would want to know why a person would want an amnio or any other genetic screening. If the parents told me, well, we are concerned about a congenital defect, and if we find out that our child has a congenital defect, we're going to kill it.
Mm.
Abortion.
Right.
Well, I couldn't go ahead and aid and abet that. I would say, you know, I just in good conscience, I cannot perform this procedure given the actions that you will accomplish as a result, because I would feel that my counsel would then be morally corrupted as a result. Now, if they said, well, you know, we are going to keep our child, but we want to be prepared emotionally and in a number of other ways for a child with a congenital defect. I mean, maybe the couple is in their late 40s or 50s, the mother is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are the kinds of pregnancies that have a higher incidence of Down syndrome. So I think it's entirely reasonable to say, we just want to know so we can plan. And if that's the rationale that's given to me for the amnio, then I'd be willing to say, okay, I could in good conscience give this procedure, which itself is morally neutral and is not going to be a kind of a falling domino into an immoral act. The causal slippery slope.
And that seems to make sense to me. What do you think about the objection that parents may say that they won't abort, that they're planning on keeping the baby no matter what,
yeah,
but then when faced with the actual positive diagnosis, that some parents might change their mind and use the test results?
Yeah, unless you have very strong reasons to believe that either you're being deceived in that moment or these people can't be trusted to keep their word, I don't think you have an obligation. I don't think you have an obligation not to do the amnio under those circumstances. I mean, if somebody lies to you, then you can't help that. Or if they change their mind, you can't help that. The fact is, under those circumstances, they're probably going to get an amnio from somebody else, and so that's going to, they're going to have the abortion anyway. I think under those circumstances, as long as you have every reasonable expectation to think that they're going to use your services in a moral way, then you have no obligation. You have no moral obligation not to do the procedure, okay? Adam, I'm going to have to run because I've got another caller right now and I want to get to them before the show is over, at least this first hour. We got a second hour where we'll be talking about Why We're Not Emergent. That's the book by Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck. Let's talk with Margaret in Rancho PV. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Greg. I wonder if you could help me. Could you tell me some of the beliefs of the Seventh-day Adventists? I was told that they don't believe in getting medical help, and I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm not quite sure there's some of their beliefs.
Well, you got me slack-jawed here a little bit, because I do know some things about Seventh-day Adventists,
uh-huh,
and the main thing is that they're Sabbatarians. That is, that they believe in worshiping on the Sabbath, Friday evening to Saturday evening and sundown to sundown, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But you may be mixing, and I can't tell you about the doctor thing. I know that Christian Scientists believe in that, but
yes.
You kind of caught me flat-footed here. I expected a different aspect of the question about Seven Adventists from you. So, there is actually a series of books dealing with cults, and I'm not suggesting that Seventh-day Adventists are always cults, because I don't think that's the case, but I think sometimes they are a little bit cultic in some of their beliefs. So what you may find is the Zondervan, I think it's the Zondervan Guide to the Cults. It's a series of booklets that is edited by Alan Gomes, G-O-M-E-S. So if you go to Amazon and you just type in A-L-A-N, Alan, and G-O-M-E-S, Gomes.
Don't have a computer. Sorry.
You'll get, I think, that series of booklets by Zondervan on the cults. And there may be one of – they're small booklets, and they're kind of an outline form, and there may be one of them devoted to Adventists that will help answer this particular question.
Maybe a Christian bookstore, because I don't have a computer.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, there you go.
Gomes, G-O-M-E-S.
Yeah, yeah. And they can order it for you. It's called The Zondervan Guide to the Cults.
Right.
Zondervan is the publisher. Now, right. I want to be careful here that I'm not suggesting. Did we just lose her? Yeah, I'm sorry, Margaret. We just lost you by accident. But we're almost out of time here anyway, so you can catch. You're in LA area, so Rancho PV, you can hear this. I'm not in suggesting that the Seventh-day Adventists are included in these booklets, and I'm not sure. I'm not just stating outright that they are a cult. There's actually some debate about that, and it depends on what kind of Seventh-day Adventist you are. There are actually, and I've met them, and in fact, I've spoken in their churches. It's been a while now, maybe 15 years, before Stand to Reason, in fact, but I was on the East Coast speaking in an Adventist church on apologetics, and I was the first non-Adventist to speak in their church. But even though they were worshiping on Saturday and they thought it was morally obligatory to do so, they did not believe that one's salvation was dependent upon worshiping on Saturday or some of the other, what some might consider peculiar doctrines or beliefs of that group. And so I think there's been there was for a while a somewhat of an evangelical movement, a movement that we would theologically be comfortable with, even though we differed on some particulars. Foundationally, they were okay. I think it seems to me I've heard that that movement has been kind of discouraged, or, you know, there's been some pushback from some of the old timers in the denomination that has kind of put a dent in that, because I think in the past many of the Seventh-day Adventists were clearly questionable, certainly heterodox, if not heretical, in many of their teachings. So anyway, there's my thoughts. Next hour, coming up, Kevin DeYoung, Ted Kluck, on why we're not emergent by two guys who should be. This is going to be an interesting conversation on their book, Dealing with the Emerging Church. Stay with us. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel with you on Stand to Reason. And, of course, this is the show where we always try to give you a piece of our mind. And when we talk with you, we try to get a piece of your mind in defense or in reflection on the critical issues of life, ethics, values, and religion, specifically as they relate to classical Christianity and classical Christian values and those points of view that challenge it. You know, we have talked for, what's it been, about 3 years now, on and off with different levels of intensity about the emerging church and my own point of view about this, or my own understanding, and my response has been seasoned over the last few years. I guess my initial response was, I would have to say, unbridled hostility was probably my first response, as I began to get reports from the kinds of things that was hearing about the Holy Emerging Church movement, and especially from its probably most visible and most vocal spokesperson, Brian McLaren. Now, of course, I came to know that there were lots of different emerging people and emerging authors, and many of those have emerged publicly over the last 3 or 4 years. And I began to get more nuanced in my response to those movements. And we've had some of those guys here on the show. You know that I've had dinner with Tony Jones and Doug Padgett and Dan Kimball, and so we've kind of tried to mix it up with these guys and get a clear understanding of what they were all about. And to be honest with you, I have not been able to keep up with all of the books that have been coming out on the emerging church. And it also, in some ways, has seemed to me to fade just a little bit into the background. And maybe it's only because it's been eclipsed now not by other postmodernists, but or those kind of in a postmodern tradition trying to reach a postmodern world and an emerging postmodern culture. But they've been eclipsed by these old-time modernists, you know, who are making a comeback, the what are called the new atheists and stuff. So that's where our focus has been lately. But I think one of the advantages of kind of having a few years for us to look at this, and when I say us, I don't mean just us as Stand to Reason, but the body of Christ in general, to look at this movement, as we become, I think, more careful and, as I mentioned a moment ago, nuanced in the way we approach this question. And I think that's why it's the book that I want to talk about this hour and the authors that I want to talk with about their book is so important. The book is called Why We Are Not Emergent, parentheses, by two guys who should be, and that would be Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck. And Kevin is a senior pastor at University Reformed Church in East Lansing, Michigan, which is right across the street from Michigan State, my kind of half alma mater, And we'll talk about that in a moment. I didn't graduate from there, but I spent a couple of years there. And Ted Kluck, who is an author of three books that look like have to do mostly with sports, though has made a tremendous contribution in this particular one, Why I'm Not Emergent. And I think we've got Ted on now, and Kevin's going to join us in a few moments because he's just coming from his own church service there in East Lansing. Ted, welcome to the show. I'm Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
Yeah, Ted, and you need to let me know when Kevin comes on board because I know you're kind of in the same office. And
yeah, I sure will.
Okay, great. I'm very excited.
Get flexibility here.
So. Yeah, that's okay. Good. I'm very excited about your book, but I have to ask you something about your vita here. It says a bi-monthly column for Sports Spectrum magazine entitled Pro and Con, which won the Evangelical Press Association Award for Best Standing Column in 2003. Now, why is the Evangelical Press Association interested in a sports column?
I have no idea. You know, it's a great question. I just got I got a little thing in the mail that said I had won that award, and that was the beginning and the end of it. But
yeah, it goes up on your wall, huh?
It must have been a light year for columns that year. That's all I can ascertain, Greg. But no, we were happy to get that.
Yeah, well, good for you. And you have alternating chapters like with Kevin in this book, Why We're Not Emergent. Let me ask you the first more obvious question here. Since
sure.
Your title is Why We're Not Emergent by Two Guys Who Should Be, why should you be emergent?
Yeah, you know what? That's a great question. And that's, you know, it's funny to write a book like this because you sort of go into it, and this was the first time it's happened to me as a writer. You go into something like this figuring that half the people that read it will probably hate it, which was a real kind of keep you up at night sort of thing.
Kind of a downer, huh?
Yeah, kind of a downer, definitely. But, you know, we haven't gotten a whole lot of flack on this yet, but the one piece of flack that we have gotten is related to this title and related to the idea that, you know, why should these guys be emergent?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we did that, number one, because it was kind of clever. So, mm-hmm. You know, in the interest of full disclosure, we thought it was just a good idea. But also, I mean, I think we should be in the sense that, you know, we saw this emergent movement appealing a lot to guys like us who were in our early 30s, college mm-hmm. educated, maybe had grown up in the church, perhaps had gone to a, you know, pretty conservative Christian college. And it seems like a lot of the energy, you know, kind of surrounding the sexiness of the rebellion of that movement was mm-hmm. directed at guys like us, you
mm-hmm.
know. And
it's like the commercial for the Mac guy versus the PC guy.
Absolutely.
Like the emerging guys are like the Mac guy, you know, relaxed and shirt out and unuptight and not anal and friendly and all that other stuff. So and that's you guys.
Yeah, and I guess we consider ourselves all those things. I'm glad you can't see me right now. I'm glad this is radio because I do have a ball cap on and my shirt out, and you know,
your hands in your pocket, you know, and kind of shrugging pocket. Every now and again. And
yeah, I guess I'm a walking cliche. You know, I don't have a Mac in front of me, but
uh-huh.
you know, all but that. So
uh-huh.
that's a little story behind the title. You know, and it's funny if you've ever written, you know that you know publishers don't often keep the titles that you suggest.
That's right. Uh huh.
You know, I'm surprised we got to use that one.
No, it's actually quite provocative, and I think it's, you know, your cover, the cover here is, you know, two guys, and I don't know if those are really you guys or not. But
yeah, it's definitely not us.
No.
I'm a little heavier than the guy.
Okay.
I'm not going to lie. I wish it was me.
But it's kind of like yellow-orange, and there are some emergent books out there, like the Emergent Manifesto that is like this, you know, got
right.
this same color scheme and everything. And I just the sense I get, even from the title, is say, look, at you know, we're not joining the crowd, and we got some principled reasons why not. And in fact, when I read the chapter titles, you really take on, you and Kevin DeYoung, take on all of the kind of icons or the iconic representations of the emerging church, you know, the dialogue stuff and the concern about propositions and the attack on modernism well, you have a great chapter here, which you wrote, actually. Thank you for smoking the on dialogue, futurism, and hell. And so I think you really what you do is you provide for the rank and file who are kind of sitting on the sidelines a little bit, or also those who are maybe caught up in this, I think a careful analysis of some of these themes that seem so appealing but in a way have a little bit of a dark side. Would that be a fair
yeah.
way of putting it?
I hope so. You know, I think that's what we strove to do, and obviously just us being two guys, we knew we weren't going to nail this thing perfectly because it's always, you know, it's ever-changing, you
mm-hmm.
know, and it's funny, you mentioned you feel like you're a little behind the eight ball in terms of, you know, staying up with the reading on this thing,
right.
And we feel the exact same way. I mean, we tried to read absolutely everything we could get our hands on kind of during the time that we were writing the book. But, you know, even since the book, you know, went to press or has come out, there have been other things written. And, you know, we don't want to kind of peg ourselves as the not emergent guys for the rest of our lives. And it's a little exhausting to keep up with all of it, to be honest with you. But yeah, I mean, we tried to hit the main themes, the main concepts, and, you know, have some fun with it and give credit where credit was due, but also, you know, do a good job of giving critique where that was due, too. And I have to tell you, Kevin is on board now. So
okay, good. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for waiting for me. I was just getting done with our evening service, so Pastor's got to do some work.
Now, did you know that I was a student at Michigan State University in 1970 to 72?
I didn't know that. Did you ever set foot in this church?
Well, I'm sure I didn't.
Oh. Did you set foot in any church?
Not back then. I didn't. I guarantee you I was not in your church. Was it around in 1970? That's 35 years ago.
Yeah, it was.
Actually, that's 38 years ago.
Yeah, started in the late 60s, 1966. Actually, there was one pastor who founded the church. He was here for 36 years. And then, so I'm the second pastor that they've had.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I didn't go to your church, but I'm very familiar with this school, and I'm sure it's changed a lot in some ways. But this was during the anti-war movement and all of the chaos of the early 70s there. But so it's kind of nice to connect with somebody from MSU.
Yes, party on.
And this, yeah, party on.
Now we have chaos when the basketball team loses, so not much has changed.
Okay. Well, Kevin and Ted, we're you know, I've read over your book, and I, Kevin, you missed my opening comments, but I think that this whole emerging thing is somewhat confusing to a lot of people that maybe are on the outside, and some for some on the inside, because they see the virtues of this new movement that is trying to reach out in a missional way, and this is kind of a catchphrase of the movement to an emerging generation. But at the same time, you know, there are some other things that at least in some cases seem to be baggage here. I want to mention one thing about the tone of the book, and I think it is really nice, conversational, and charitable, and not polemical, which I think is going to appeal to more of those people that associate themselves with the emerging generation. But it also is, I think, appropriately reflective. So some of his older characters, you know, that are a little bit more left brain are going to find things that are worth chewing on there. Let me ask you a definitional question, and maybe Kevin, you can weigh in on this one. This word emerging or emergent is a wildly flexible term, and you admit so in the book, but insofar as you are addressing the emerging movement, you must have some kind of broad definition in mind. Maybe you can share that with us as we start out this conversation.
Yeah, that's one of the first questions people always ask, and it's probably the hardest question. As you noted in the first couple chapters, we talk about some of the differences between emerging and emergent, and if people want to make the distinction, emerging are just churches trying to do things in a little bit of a different style to reach a new generation. That's not what the book is about.
Mm-hmm.
Emergent, the official organization, that's sort of what the book is about, but it's a little broader than that. You know, Carson in his book talks about the emergent church as a protest movement against modernism and seeker-sensitive churches and conservative evangelicalism. So we see it as some of that. You know, the 5-second version I usually tell people is it's trying to accommodate Christianity to a postmodern worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not very helpful because no one really understands what postmodernism is, including me. But it's trying to do church in a different way and deconstruct language and theology. You know, I was talking to one of the authors who we critique in the book in a couple of places, and he was calling to just, hey, I read your book, and here's some of my thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what you guys are really doing is critiquing creeping liberalism in the church. And I thought that's a pretty good description. We see some of the same things that the church has dealt with over the past 100 years, and they're just coming up, and they're dressed up in some MTV garb, but it's the same sort of issues we've seen before.
You know, I am so glad to hear this comment from you because, I mean, the way you just put it, because this, to some degree, has been my take. If we are making a distinction between the broader emerging church movement, which might be characterized, I think, as Dan Campbell put it, you know, those churches trying to reach out to the emerging culture in some kind of relevant way, and this a narrower group that I think the word you use is accommodate, which I take as a pejorative, that there is some kind of adjusting in a foundational sense that's inappropriate to address or to become more palatable to the emerging culture. If you see those are the distinctions, I think, between the emerging church in general and the emergent village types, like Tony Jones and Doug Padgett and Brian McLaren are probably the most well-known names associated with that organization, then I think you put your finger on an important observation that, God, when you look at the theology of some of these guys, it sounds like it's sounding more and more like just old-fashioned liberalism, but animated not by modernist impulse, but by postmodern impulse.
Yeah, I think it's hyper-modern. In a lot of ways, it's not new stuff. You see all of the same things. That's why I quote J. Gresham Machen so many times in the book, because you read Christianity and Liberalism, which was, you know, Machen's in the 1920s and 30s, like he's speaking to our culture.
The old same, Princetonian.
Yeah, the same neo-Orthodox view of Scripture that the Bible isn't the Word of God, but it becomes the Word of God. The same squishiness about hell and uncomfortability with substitutionary atonement. I mean, it's the same sort of things. And, you know, somebody like Dan Kimball, I've had some good interaction with. I think, you know, we disagree, but I do think he is in the historic Christianity trying to do things a little different way. And so you put it well that some of these other guys are in a different category. And even the phrase reaching out, or these guys want to reach out to a postmodern generation, can be very slippery, because some of the people in the pews we hear reach out and we think, oh, isn't that wonderful? But if you press these guys, reach out for them doesn't mean we want to see conversions.
It's not Great Commission stuff.
It's not Great Commission. It's not repent and put faith in Christ so that you can live a new life and be assured of heaven instead of the dangers of hell. I mean, it's go out and be like Jesus, which is a different kind of evangelism than most people understand it.
Well, let me ask you a question, Kevin, especially since there you are at MSU. You're on campus. I mean, you're just off campus.
Yeah.
You know, you're a couple blocks. By the way, for people who don't realize it, East Lansing is Michigan State University, or it was when I was there, and I don't know if that's changed much. This is a massive, massive campus with a huge population that just consumes the whole community. I don't know if it's still like that, but that's kind of the way it was. So if you live in East Lansing, you're pretty much this is college town par excellence kind of thing.
Right.
And so given that, what is your take now? It's very different than it was 38 years ago when I was a student there. But what is your take now on the student's perspective of Christianity? You know, you've got this book Unchristian out, which is kind of a, you know, an analysis of what people think. And I know I'm trying to think of his name. I just drew a blank. We were just talking about him.
Kimball.
Dan Kimball. Thank you. I'm sorry. Dan Kimball's new book, They Like Jesus But Not the Church. You know, you get this picture of the college students as being really kind of hostile towards Christianity, or have these really bad attitudes about it. And do you find that there as a pastor in a looks like a Reformed church, is that? Yeah, University
right.
Reformed Church.
Yeah.
So this is like as kind of like evangelical as you can get, you know, theologically. These,
right.
In many people's mind, Calvinist. Boy, that's really extreme. what is your sense of the reaction of the students in your community there to your kind of Christianity?
Yeah, of course it's hard to say, because the ones that come here and stay here either like something about it, or God meets them here and changes them so that they grow to like something about it. I mean, I do find some things have changed. I mean, the no knock on the Josh McDowell kind of apologetics, but probably the sort of stuff Tim Keller is doing is a little bit more where college students are at. But having said that, I talk to, we have two full-time people who do campus ministry, and they tell me, you know what, Kevin, it's the same sort of stuff. I mean, it's, did Jesus really come back to life? Can I really trust the Bible? What about the problem of evil? So, yeah, there's different shades to things, and we need to be aware of what's going on around us. But a lot of these college students have the same sort of concerns that college students have had for a long time. And one of the things Ted and I have reflected on a number of times, just thinking about the emergent church, is one of our theories is that the emergent church really flourishes most in places where there's a lot of de-churched Christians. You know, I grew up in Grand Rapids, an hour down the road.
Did you say de-churched?
De-churched.
D-E. What would that be?
As opposed to unchurched. People who are
disaffected.
Been in church. Yeah, they're disaffected. They're maybe sliding towards unbelief, some of them, or they feel like, I kind of want to be a Christian, but I just don't like being a Christian.
In other words, these are the kind of guys that like something like A New Kind of Christian.
Absolutely.
Really appeals to this McLaren's book.
Yeah, it feels sort of sexy. It gives you a chance to rebel. And Ted and I have often talked about, you know, at least we find the college students here, they get the postmodern stuff in their class. They get the relativism. They give something that's solid. Tell me what you think. What's the truth? And, you know, I grew up in Grand Rapids, and there's a pretty big emergent-type church there, and I think it can flourish some of those places where there's a lot of Christians who have kind of some Christian background, and they just get tired, and they get sort of bored of it. And so the emergent church allows them to do something that feels fresh and innovative and creative and, you know, isn't going to have as many edges to it and just allows them to kind of be coddled in some of their dissatisfaction with the church.
We're talking with Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck. Their book is Why We're Not Emergent, by two guys who should be, 30-something guys who are involved in ministry and writing and reflection on our culture, and I think have done a very nice job of reflecting productively on the entire merging church project, and read a lot of books and talked to some of these main players here, and it's clear from their work that they've reflected on this well. I commend the book to you. We'll be back in just a moment with Kevin and Ted, and we'll talk to them more about why we're not emergent. I'm Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Tired of defending your faith with, the Bible says so, does too, or I think it does? Do you remove yourself from conversations with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Stop being unprepared and call today for the latest issue of Solid Ground, the bi-monthly newsletter of Stand to Reason. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you articulate your faith and have a biblically grounded understanding of subjects like same-sex marriage, evolution, stem cell research, and partial birth abortion. Don't be embarrassed or unprepared when you stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel teaches you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive yet effective manner. Learn tactics tempered with wisdom that make your beliefs persuasive, not naive. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Ask for the latest copy of Solid Ground to be sent to you today. It's free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. What's with the wild rock and roll here? Is that like to take me back to the early 70s? We need like Black Sabbath or something like that, you know, or Simon and Garfunkel would have been a good one to do. Talking with Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck, why we're not emergent, the reference to the 70s is the fact that in the early 70s, I was at Michigan State University, and this is where Kevin's church is University Reformed Church in East Lansing, Michigan. And Ted Kluck is the author of three books that, like, mostly about sports. Did you actually write a book on boxing?
Yeah,
Yeah, I sure did. That was my first book. It was called Facing Tyson, 15 Fighters, 15 Stories, and got to interview 15 guys that fought Mike Tyson, which was
no
a great
kidding.
Privilege. Yeah,
it was awesome. Did you interview the guy that was missing part of his ear?
I sure did, yeah, Evander Holyfield. I got to interview him down at his mansion in Atlanta, so okay. it was a wild ride.
Did he ever get his ear back?
Yeah, you know what? There's still a little chunk missing. It's really hard not to look at it when you're talking. So, you know, I wrote about that and other hard-hitting things in the book. So.
Yeah, hard-hitting. Okay, yeah, I got
right,
it.
Right.
Well, in spite of the fact that you write about boxing or whatever, you have done an excellent job in your contribution with Kevin here on Why We're Not Emergent by two guys who should be. Actually, you know, I got the sense here, and I'm not sure whose chapter I was reading, but it was almost like not exactly a stream of consciousness style, which is really popular back in the 70s, but it's basically your, and maybe this is something that's appealing to the emerging mindset now, it's kind of like you're moving kind of almost conversationally from topic to topic. I read a really engaging section of someone, was this you, Ted, who was in the car with D.A. Carson and kind of having a little chat with him about things, and was that you, Ted?
That was me, Driving Mr. D'Azy, I think was my subtitle, which Moody desperately wanted to take out. But we got to keep that in there.
Well, yeah, that's good. That and it's because D.A. Carson has written, it probably would be fair to say on balance in criticism of the emerging church, though he is careful to point out some of the advantages or some of the good observations it makes or contributions they make to Christianity today. Let me revisit something with you, Ted, for a moment that Kevin brought up a few minutes ago, and that has to do with apologetics and logic. And I just had a call in my own show last hour about the role of apologetics with the postmodern crowd. Now, I kind of track with Francis Schaeffer, and he says, you know, whenever age you're in, they're still made in the image of God, human beings are, and they still have to live in the world that God made. And even if they deny the role of logic, they still function with those things all the time. And I know you said, Kevin said, that you know, people don't resonate so much with Josh McDowell as they do with, say, Tim Keller, who's got a big church out there in the middle of New York City. He's just written a book called The Reason for God, I think. But it seems to me the big difference between McDowell and Keller is really not so much in content but in tone. And so is the thing going on here, in your view, Ted, it isn't that the kind of the emerging culture doesn't care about careful thinking. They just care about how you talk to them more.
Yeah.
That's really the issue here. Would that be a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, I think that would be a very fair way of putting it, absolutely. I mean, and somebody like Tim Keller is, you know, he's out on the East Coast. He's in New York City. He does a great job of communicating with, you know, a pretty liberal, pretty intellectual audience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that definitely speaks to his popularity.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, I take him as a genial person. I saw him. Not only his writing style, but I heard him interviewed once, and he just seems relaxed, you know. And
yeah.
And Josh, and there's nothing. This isn't a criticism, but Josh is like I kind of picture a Christian Mel Gibson, you know. Mel Gibson just seems to be always so full of energy, you know, as an actor and as a person, and that's the way Josh seems. And though he's still doing great work, and we're doing a cruise with him in a couple of months, he'll be our main speaker for that. At the same time, it does seem like there's a place for this kind of more relaxed style that seems to resonate with this emerging generation.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the points we made in the book is that you can be relaxed and you can be humble, but you can still believe things. And I think that's kind of where the rubber met the road for us in terms of, yeah, absolutely, we want to be conversational with people. You know, we want to be intentional about reaching out and engaging people where they are. But at the end of the day, the onus is still on us to share the gospel and to let the gospel be, you know, central and preeminent in everything that hopefully we do and say and mm-hmm. write. And I think that's what Tim Keller manages to do really well in a really tough audience.
Right.
And I would just add, you know, with Tim Keller, he really is doing presuppositional apologetics. I don't know what your stand is on how you approach some mm-hmm. of these things. There's probably room for a little of both. But
yeah, that's the way. I mean, more eclectic. But,
yeah, he's really gracious, but he's really kind of trying to understand a postmodern worldview and then showing what the inconsistencies are.
Mm-hmm.
And he's completely using the law mm-hmm. of non-contradiction and logic. And mm-hmm. people say, you know, postmoderns aren't logical or they don't want careful thinking. Well, they don't want careful thinking when they want to believe what they want to believe. You know, but when it comes down to their opinions, I mean, you talk to somebody who objects to Christianity because of, say, Bart Ehrman's book about textual criticism, suddenly they become incredibly logical, and they want to know numbers and how many manuscripts and this thing and that thing.
Yeah, they'll be misquoting Jesus.
Yeah, misquoting Jesus, right.
Yeah, I the caller earlier, one of the things that came up in this discussion about whether postmoderns like logic or not is they do seem to raise the same kind of objection to the problem of evil, for example, which really trades on the law of non-contradiction. You know, moderns were no less susceptible to bad thinking when, you know, their own kind of cherished views were at stake. So it seems to me this is really characteristic of the human condition, and it isn't really dictated as much by the postmodern or the modern mindset. Kevin, you mentioned earlier that the kids at school get all this relativism in class, and I inferred from that, and I just didn't want to misunderstand you, that it's like, yeah, they get it all in class, but they don't entirely take it seriously, and they are looking and hungering for something they can really sink their teeth into. Did I read you right there?
Well, I think, you know, at least from my experience, and, you know, there's 45,000 students here, so I'm sure you can find any sort of experience you're looking for, but at least the students that come here, you know, they want something that's going to shoot straight with them and go through the Bible. Tell me what it believes. And, you know, we are a Reformed church, and we don't talk about the 5 points of Calvinism every Sunday, but we got a lot of Calvinists running around here, and we try to make sure they don't just run into other people and run over people. Calvinists like to do that.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, but they want to learn and they want to grow, and they're sponges. And if people will respect their intelligence and challenge them, and, you know, one of the things we said in the book is the emergent church may feel like all the postmoderns or 20-somethings or 30-somethings are enamored with mystery. There's probably some of those, but there's just as many others who are just tired of, you know, lazy thinking and paradox and just being reheated and served up to us as mystery and something that's very profound. And it's like, you know what, these are just sort of epigrams that you're giving us. God is nowhere. God is no here.
Yeah.
Now here. I quote that.
Now
in the book.
Here, right.
That doesn't help your college student. I mean, maybe if you're a philosophy major, but if you've got to, you know, live your whole life, that doesn't do anything.
Well, my reflection on that is that there's a difference between mystery and ignorance.
Yeah.
You know, and after you've done all that you could to, and you know this as a, you know, as a pastor and clearly having academic inclinations just as part of your own field here, after you've done all your due diligence to clear up as much ignorance as you possibly can, there is plenty of mystery left to go around, you know.
Right. So you don't lead with mystery, but when you get to some of these things in the faith, you say, look, there's some things we can't understand, and the emergent church is good to remind us of that. But, of course, Paul was preaching in Athens and saw a statue to an unknown god, and he didn't tell everyone, hey, Athenians, this is great. This is my god. I don't understand him either. No, he went and he explained who this god was.
Yeah, that which you worship in ignorance, I proclaim to you clearly. Listen, Ted, do you think these are, in your conversations with these different guys and your reading of them on reflection, do you think that they offer any useful or important insights to us that we need to take into consideration? Or I guess I think that you do. So let me ask you, what do you think that should we be taking from them as genuine observations or instruction that would be helpful in our enterprise?
Sure. Yeah, I think they do. I think, you know, I kind of, a little background as to how I got involved with this project, coming from a sports background. You know, we had several years ago a great guy in our church who was kind of passing around a lot of these emergent books and encouraging those of us who seemed young and cool, I guess, to read them and think about them and, you know, think about, I guess, going emergent, although that sounds like a pretty modern, you know, phrase there. But so I did that, and I really didn't know what I thought of the movement. I'd never heard of the movement before reading some of these books. And initially, I think my reaction was, okay, here's a group of people that does church a little bit differently. You know, they probably don't do some things that I would be into, but it's basically okay in the sense that you know, hey, we're trying to reach out to more artistic people or people that care about social justice and poverty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are all good things, and these are all things that I want the church to be about. So I think in that sense, you know, the emergent church gets some things right. You know, I mean, we do need to be challenged to not, quote-unquote, be in the bubble. You know, the bubble is kind of a whipping boy. That's something people like to beat up. But I think there's a balance there, obviously. I mean, mm-hmm. I've come to really love and appreciate the bubble in the sense that, you know, we get great fellowship with other believers at our church. We get to come hear the Bible preached every Sunday.
And, right, right. You know, by the way, just to bring people up to speed, I think the bubble there is the kind of could be spoken of pejoratively as the isolation of the Christian community. So you're hanging out with each other and you're in this protective bubble. And what you're saying is, well, there's a nice part of that that's entirely legitimate. But if that bubble membrane is impermeable, then that's a problem, huh? Is that a fair way of putting it?
Exactly, exactly. And, yeah, so I would say, especially at the beginning of my reading, I was probably more sympathetic to the emergent message, obviously, than I am now. But you know, there are some good things there. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be about those good things. You know, while at the same time, not throwing away the gospel in the process.
But here is something that's troubled me, though, even about that statement. I always reacted to the concept of social justice because social justice means helping the poor, and the language suggests that people are poor because they've been treated unjustly, and to me that's a Marxist message, and it's not really accurate, at least in this country, in most cases. But in any event, I'm glad that they're helping the poor, but I kind of get the feeling that they think that they discovered the poor.
Absolutely. I think that's a point that I try to make in my chapters. You know, there's this sort of breathless, self-congratulatory tone of, hey, we discovered social justice, and, mm-hmm. you know, nobody cared about doing mercy ministry until we figured it out. And,
right, right.
You know, that was something that real early on, I think Kevin and I took umbrage to.
Right.
You know, because we had been, I don't know where these churches are that you know, these kind of wounded emergent guys came out of. I know they're out there and all that, but, you know, we really didn't come out of those churches. Mm-hmm. I think we were lucky and blessed to be in a lot of pretty good, small, humble churches that, you know, we know a lot of people that do mercy ministry. I mean, there are folks here that very quietly are about a lot of the things that the emergent church says it's about. So, you know, this kind of self-congratulatory stance of, you know, hey, we've got to completely blow this thing up before we can start doing church right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got to beat people over the head with this so that they'll care about it. I think people are already caring about it.
Yeah, you know, I've been a, you know, church every week. You know, I'm in probably 100 different locations a year in you know, public speaking. And every church, you know, you look at the bulletin and there it is. You know, there's things that they're doing, but they're not waving their flag and they're not sounding their trumpet, that kind of thing. I became a Christian in 1973 during the Jesus movement. And, you know, we were nonconformists, you know, and we had, like, you know, guitars and services were big. That was a big deal, you know. That was totally breaking the mold. And so, and we discovered the poor. I mean, it sounds so much like, the attitude, in a sense, of the young during the Jesus movement. But here's a reflection on that I'd like you both to respond to. And in a piece I wrote recently regarding this issue, I said, you know what, it seems to me every generation needs an emerging group of Christians to speak the gospel in a fresh way to an emerging generation. And I think the Jesus movement did that in the 70s in a way that was vital, and it has its liabilities and its strengths. And I think that the emerging movement, taken as a broad movement now, is attempting to do that. And I think insofar as it's attempting to do that, this is something vital to do because, you know, I'm going to hang up my cleats pretty soon. I'm an old-timer. You know, I don't speak the language, you know, as well. One guy told me, Kokel, if you think it's too loud, you're too old, you know. And so I think we need an emerging generation of Christians that know how to speak the ancient message in a contemporary fashion that's meaningful. Well, let's start with Kevin on that one, and then I'd like to hear, Ted, what your response is to that.
It's hard to disagree with that. My hesitation would be in affirming that the emergent church is getting the gospel right. Certainly some of them are, and even if there's some disagreements or different style things, they are. But what was most saddening to me in reading all the emergent literature, probably 5,000 pages, is that so many of them have traded gospel for law. And by that I mean the message that they're telling people is, look, we live in a fallen world. Jesus came to show how much God loves us and to bring about his kingdom and to bring this world where there's social justice and there's peace and there's shalom and this new creation. So come, follow Jesus, live like him, do what he does, be his disciple in the world. Now, you listen to that and you say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, there's no cross there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always telling our congregation that the gospel is not, first of all, a message about what you need to do for God. It's a message about what God has done for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the gospel, quote unquote, that comes across in so much of the emergent literature is all imperative statements and no indicative statements.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll say the gospel is not a message, it's an invitation to a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that'll sell because there's no offense there. You're just telling people, look, Jesus was a great guy. Jesus loved people. Jesus forgave. Jesus was probably had left-leaning politics, they would say. And come and be like Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, one evangelist came on campus and he sort of finished his crusade by holding up a crayon and saying, all right, go take your crayons and go paint the world red for Christ. But that's imperative, telling us what we need to do when, first of all, we need to hear a message about what God has done for us on the cross, how Jesus bore our curse. So I have no problem with, a Mark Driscoll. I wouldn't always use the same language he uses, but there's somebody who's speaking to a culture. He's speaking in a way that people can listen to,
right?
But he's giving the gospel, and that's what's most disheartening is I wonder if we're telling, and Doug Padgett says this very same thing, we are telling two very different stories of the gospel.
Yeah, but I think you mentioned Driscoll and Padgett. They're kind of in the same sentence, and I suspect you would really distinguish strongly between them with regards to the issue you're talking about. Would that
be
fair?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, Driscoll, okay, that's fine. He's just speaking a different language. He's speaking the same gospel for sure. Doug Padgett, totally different story.
Right, good. When I come back from break, I'll ask you, Ted, to respond to that same question. My guests, Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck. By the way, Ted, I didn't ask you if I was pronouncing your last name correctly. Is that right?
Yeah, you're doing great, man.
Okay, because my name is weird, too, and people get it wrong. And all right, good. Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck, their book, Why We're Not Emergent, by two guys who should be. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason. Stay with us for our final segment.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on Is the Supernatural Real? Is Jesus a Prophet or the Son of God? Do All Roads Lead to God? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Are they doing that on purpose? No, that isn't. I thought maybe that was kind of like a new kind of music or something, like hip-hop rock or something. I don't know. Great. Well, that ended abruptly. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. My guests, Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck, and their book, Why We're Not Emergent, by two guys who should be. And, you know, my suggestion about books like this is if you're, you know, kind of just wondering about the emerging movement, and you want to critique by guys that are evangelicals but are not nasty and are thoughtful and are in this culture that the emerging church is seeking to reach, I suggest you take a read here because it's a lot of fun. And they both make a good contribution to the broad issues that are part of what the emerging movement entails. And I'd asked a question of Kevin first. I want to hear what Ted's response was. And it's just the perspective. The question is the perspective that, you know, every generation needs of emerging, every emerging generation needs a kind of a new generation of emerging Christians to speak the ancient message in a fresh way, in a way that's understood to them. And this is really what it means to be missional, to reach cross culture. By the way, I'll add one other thing then, Ted, to you, is what I recall from the Jesus movement, which was really, you know, my genesis with following Jesus, is that part of the problem there, as I look back, is you've got the new generation that is, you know, I think needful for a fresh proclamation of the gospel. But there are a lot of young people who kind of forget upon whose shoulders they stand and maybe move ahead a little too quickly. And then you got the old guard that, you know, is hanging on a little too tightly, you know, but is important in the process. And so there's always that kind of heave-ho. And I think I see some of that heave-ho going on right now. Anyway, what do you think of the question? What's your response?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about it during the break, just about how speaking the language might be a little bit overrated, just in the sense that, you know, I think with this postmodern generation, if you seem like you're trying too hard to speak the language, that can come off as inauthentic or less than cool or whatever. But, you know, I'll give you two quick examples from the book. One was a guy I went to college with, young guy, about 30, preaching the gospel. He's a pastor at a very diverse community, Passaic, New Jersey. And, you know, Corey is a guy that, you know, very much would be not emergent in terms of, you know, he's not cool, he's not hip, he's not trying to do anything, you know, real edgy with his worship service. But he's a young guy who's preaching the gospel. And I think, you know, he's doing it in a very diverse community. He's living incarnationally, to, you know, borrow an emergent term. And, you know, I think there are a lot of these guys out there, again, under the radar, who are doing this. The other example would be...
So, in other words, he's not wearing blue jeans and a work shirt and big, heavy black shoes, and he's got his hair spiked or nothing like that,
It's like, there's nothing wrong with any of that stuff, but, you know, I think his authenticness comes from...
being himself.
Hey, here's a guy in an old church doing his best to love his people and preach the gospel,
right.
You know, and when I go and worship with Corey, I'm proud of him, and I'm proud to know Christ in that environment. You know, it's a very encouraging place for me. And I think the other one real quick was just, Kevin mentioned the previous pastor of this church. You know, he's a guy who's, when he wrapped up his tenure as pastor, I think he was in his early 70s, he's in his mid-70s now, and this is a guy that stopped probably caring what the kids were into a long, long time ago, yet he still has college students on his doorstep all the time. I mean, this is a guy with a heart and a passion for young people. And, you know, they go to Tom because they feel loved by Tom. You know, they don't go because he listens to the music that they're into. They don't go so they can talk about, you know, spiritual metaphor and the Matrix and, you know, do it over lattes and listen to guitar music or anything else. I mean, they do it because here's a guy that loves me and cares about me and wants to share the gospel with me. So, you know, I think in a sense we do have to be mindful of speaking the language of a generation, and hopefully just as young writers, Kevin and I do that, you know, I mean, hopefully we write in such a way that reflects our generation, but, you know, I still think there are a lot of folks doing a good job communicating the message.
Yeah, and sometimes... Yeah, trying to adjust that too aggressively almost seems patronizing and, as you say, inauthentic or phony.
It feels a little cheesy. You know, you go into these churches with, you know, lights strung up and candles and coffee and different stations and, you know, clips from whatever spiritually hip movie is out lately playing. And there's a little bit of a three-legged puppy aspect of it, where you just cringe and say, "Ooh, they're trying too hard."
Yeah,
you know?
Right, right. Well, you know, when you were describing your friend, is it Corey?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of Tim Keller, because Tim Keller's kind of like a middle-aged balding guy, you know, and they don't even use PowerPoint at their church, from what I understand. So there's nothing fancy there. There's just
right.
good, solid Bible teaching and good communication skills and authenticity. This may sound like redundant, but genuine authenticity. In other words, they're just being who they are, trying to love people in the context of their own cultural trappings and their own personality. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the irony of the whole thing. People that are good at being authentic probably don't try at all to be authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the same way with people who you walk away from the interaction and you're like, wow, that person was really cool,
mm-hmm.
you know. And cool usually means we had a great conversation. You know, the person cared about me. They asked great questions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think whether one has the trappings of cool or not, depending on what those are for a given demographic, you know, people just – they want to be loved and cared about. And
you could,
you know,
in other words, you can be you can wear a coat and tie and, you know, kind of have the you know, jarhead haircut and still and be 50s something.
This
sounds like somebody I know. But at the same time, you know, be genuine and personable and down to earth in the way you communicate.
I think people are looking for the same thing they've always been looking for. They want to know, are you thoughtful? Are you a real person? Are
mm-hmm.
you going to be honest with me? And then maybe what the emergent church can help some more traditional evangelicals see is not to be scared of people who are different. I mean, that's what I pick up from Keller, and I hope we do in this church. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I wear khaki pants and a button-up shirt and look pretty like, you know, a pastor might
Nordstrom's
look like. Well, I can't afford Nordstrom's, whatever gets on sale at Kohl's for me.
Okay.
But, you know, hopefully we're a place that if you come in here and you got tattoos and you're pierced or you're wearing goth, hey, welcome. We're glad you're here.
Uh-huh.
And maybe that's what's instructive with your analogy with the Jesus movement. It's too many people when that went on. You know, you had the Jesus movement, maybe had some undiscerning things, but you had the traditional church just freaking out because hair got to a certain length,
mm-hmm.
or majoring on the minors. And if you can love people and see past some of that stuff, then I think you be yourself and you think through the Bible and God's going to use you.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking here to Ted, and I'd like you both can weigh in on this, and we just got about 4 minutes to go here.
Sure.
Gee, we could talk for a lot longer. I hope I get to come up to East Lansing sometime before too long and hang out with you guys.
That'd be great.
That'd be great, yeah.
Ted, do you live in East Lansing, or are you just visiting for the phone call?
No, I actually go to Kevin's church. So,
oh, okay. Well,
you know,
great.
That was kind of part of the energy behind the book was, you know, we've been together. We've been friends for several years.
Oh, that's great.
You know, well, do something together.
This is a book on a chapter on thank you for smoking. I think that's Ted's chapter, I'm not sure. But you make a comment here, quick responses from each of you. But basically, this documentary, Thank You for Smoking, is about how people use language to persuade people to do ridiculous things. And sometimes it's the style, not the substance, that makes the biggest difference, unfortunately. And the statement you make here, Ted, is by and large, I think right now at least, the emergent movement has the best mouthpiece. Not necessarily the best idea, but the best mouthpiece. So what can we learn from that?
Well, I mean, I just think the guys that are selling a lot of books in the emergent movement, I mean, some of them write well. You know,
mm-hmm.
some of them are very winsome communicators. They're good public speakers. And
McLaren would be a good example, I think, of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian McLaren is, you know, he's great on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
I came on after him a few weeks ago on a show, and, you know, he's very winsome and personable, and you know, I'm sure he's that way in person. He's that way to a certain extent in print. I mean, I think
right.
Donald Miller's book, Blue Like Jazz, people love that because it didn't read like a Christian book,
right.
you know. And Christian books are boring, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these guys, I think they struck a chord in the sense that, you know, they communicate well. And these are guys that would probably be successful in other industries if they pursued other things. So, I'm rambling a little bit. What was your original question?
No, I was... Now you sound like me. In both regards, rambling and forgetting where you're at. I think you're answering it, because the point you were making in the chapter was something like, you know, you guys are persuasive because they're nice and they're clever and they're good communicators, but it doesn't mean that their ideas are always so good. And I think the application for us is probably, well, we should watch our tone and how we communicate. Even though we have the truth, it doesn't mean it's going to get us any converts or persuade people if we're not careful about the way we talk. Kevin, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with Ted, and I think that what the emergent church often does well is to take seriously what other people are saying. Now, I don't know if they take our book seriously, but at least the non-Christians seriously, and sometimes that's where we need to learn in the, you know, some conservative wing of things, and we can talk or write books and sort of with a tone of, oh, you morons, why can't you see this, or you're all blind, why can't you just understand that? And again, somebody like Tim Keller does a good job of affirming up to a point, oh, these are some thoughtful objections, but then trying to bring to the truth. So if we can have more good Christian writers like Ted, and if we can just be kind and patient enough to really try to understand what some of the objections are, and then give the truth in a winsome and, I always say, winsomely dogmatic way, I think people will listen.
Maybe dogmatic, a better word would be confident, appropriately confident.
Sure.
Because dogmatic's got a negative
connotation. Winsomely dogmatic. That's my goal in life. Yeah. I don't know if I do either of those things, but I'm trying.
You know, along the line of this particular point we're talking about here, I remember seeing a news clip recently, and maybe you saw it too. It was a bit of a storied exchange between John MacArthur and Doug Padgett on the issue of yoga, because Padgett was doing the yoga thing. And you know, if you closed your eyes and you listened to John MacArthur, I think you listen to the content, he's a brilliant guy, and I think he's got great ideas. And I think Padgett was way out in left field. But if you open your eyes and watched both of them, there's MacArthur in his suit, and you know, he's getting a little older, and he kind of looks like death warmed over. And Padgett doesn't have his hair combed, and his shirt's all disheveled, and he looks like the nicest guy like some guy you'd have a beer with, next door, talking. And there was this kind of visual appeal that was going on. Even though I sided with the ideas of MacArthur, I kind of wanted to be identified with Padgett. And that's the kind of the problem I think you're talking about here.
Yeah, and I think we, in those sort of situations as Christians, we forget, I'm not on CNN here preaching to my church, but to a whole bunch of mostly people that aren't in church. And so I have to not change the message, but you meet them a little bit and you speak to them without assuming that they're all on your same page. I saw the same thing. I agreed with John MacArthur. I thought, relate a little bit, and man, I feel bad saying that because he's done a wonderful ministry.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Years,
I'm with you on that, and I think he does seem to be just a tad strident, but that's kind of his style. It's time for somebody else to kind of, maybe a Tim Keller kind of, to be on a show like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I thought what Padgett was saying was just absurd and really dangerous when you assess the point that he was making. You know, of course Jesus would be in favor of yoga because Jesus was in favor of peace and love, and yoga is about peace or internal peace, and so there you go. I mean, oh gosh, Lord help us.
As we say in boxing, those styles make fights, and I think that was a TV producer's dream, and that you had two very divergent styles on one screen, and we laughed about it. The whole thing was kind of unintentionally hilarious at some point. So
you saw the same clip, I guess. Huh?
Yeah. We saw it together, I think. So.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your hard work on your book, Why We're Not Emergent, by two guys who should be. Very nicely written, easy to read, and very engaging. And I think a very, very charitable, considering all of the issues that are involved. You did a great job. Kevin DeYoung and Ted Kluck.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
We appreciate it.
And I love to be able to hang out with you down there in East Lansing someday. Maybe it'll happen. God,
that'd be great. We'll take you to the Peanut Barrel and we'll hang out.
All right. Was the Peanut Barrel there 35 years ago?
It was.
I don't know. It looks like they haven't swept the floors in 35 years.
Yeah, I don't think it's been cleaned in 35 years. So
all right. I'll
take us on a Why We're Not Emergent cruise.
Okay. So, there you go. We'll do that. Okay.
Yeah.
All the best to you, gentlemen. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Ted Kluck, Kevin DeYoung, and Why We're Not Emergent, by two guys who should be. And they were fun guys, too. So let's see. Moody Publishers are the publishers. And, if you have kind of been challenged by the emerging movement or the emergent church or any aspect of it and are wondering about all of the iconic kinds of challenges that they have offered to these allegedly modernist evangelical church. This is a book definitely worth reading. Well, that's all the time we have. Friends, it's been great being with you this afternoon. I will see you next time. In the meantime, be a good ambassador for Christ. Be intentional about being an ambassador with an accurately informed mind, an artful method, and an attractive manner. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Go out and give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.